Diamond Cluster Wavelengths, show number 4.
Diamond Cluster Wavelengths Podcast. Discussions about the open cell phone. Platform for inventing the future.
Welcome to the fourth edition of the Diamond Cluster Wavelengths Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Diamond Cluster International, a premier global management consulting firm that helps leading organizations develop and implement growth strategies, improve operations, and capitalize on technology. The discussions here, like the firm, will cover a combination of business and technology. I'm Dan Bricklin, and with me is John Sviokla, Diamond Cluster Vice Chairman and Global Managing Director of Innovation and Research. Hi, John.
Hey, Dan.
Our guest today is Donna Dubinsky. After a 10-year stint at Apple in the 1980s, she joined Jeff Hawkins in 1992 to become president and CEO of Palm Computing. In 1998, she and Jeff left Palm to found Handspring, which eventually developed the Trio, a combination PDA and cell phone. Handspring is now part of Palm, and Donna serves on its board. She's also on the board of Intuit and is a trustee of both the Computer History Museum and the Redwood Neuroscience Institute. This March, she co-founded a new company based on Jeff Hawkins' neuroscience research. She holds a BA from Yale University and an MBA from my alma mater and where John used to teach, the Harvard Business School. Welcome, Donna.
Thanks, Dan. I'm happy to be here.
The reason I asked you to join us is that you're now removed from the day-to-day business of cell phones and carriers. I'm looking for perspective from someone who went through these things in the past and could shed light on our future. With the original Palm Pilot, you got to launch something that became a new platform. Was the Palm designed to be open? Did you court third-party developers? Yeah?
Yeah, and when we first did the Palm, one of, I think, the really big ideas about it was going to have handheld computing be a platform environment much as the PC was. And I think that when we did the Palm OS, one of our first products was the developer kit. It was a very high priority for us. And to me, the robust developer community was, in fact, one of the most fantastic things that happened with the Palm. People came up with applications that we never would have dreamed of. So it was really compelling.
Like what type of applications they come up with?
Oh, anything from serious business applications to games to things like tracking wild animals with bushmen in Africa. It just was surprising how many different things people could think of that were not on our list.
And did that help it?
Absolutely. There's no doubt that people would buy Palm Pilots to run specific applications. They didn't use it the same way they did on the PC. On the desktop, people had 3 to 5 core applications that everybody had. In the Palm world, we built those in. You didn't buy those afterwards. They were an integrated part of the product. The personal information manager, the contact list, the calendar, those were the core applications. But what we found was rather than adding 3 to 5 applications on a device, customers would find one that was compelling for them and that to them was a make it or break it thing. It might have been the stars and what the stars are. It might have been world traveler applications, or it might have been querying a detailed database at work, but there was always some additional compelling application for the Palm owner.
So it's a different type of long tail.
Yes, right, though we certainly didn't know of long tails at the time.
Right, so it's like people would make it the one that they would have, and okay.
The other part of it that was a change from the PC world was this idea of it worked out of the box. So even though it was a platform, you didn't have to add the platform functionality. And that moves us a little bit, as we'll talk later, towards the cell phone world. But remember, when you bought a PC, it really didn't do anything. You had to go out and get yourself VisiCalc, where I met you in those days, or some other application that made this piece of hardware do something important. It started changing with the Palm world. With the Palm world, we shipped these integrated applications, burned in a ROM, so it was an organizer as well. It just was an organizer that could also, by the way, be a computer and do more.
Your applications, we could burrow into your applications, is that right? So that the add-ons that people wrote, they they could take advantage of what you already had or not?
Oh, yes. In fact, we did something that was pretty radical. I remember arguing with Jeff Hawkins about it because I thought it was so dangerous, and he convinced me it was the right thing to do, and he was really proven right, which was that we actually made available the source code for all of the core applications to the developer community. This enabled the developer community to get a running start on doing enhanced versions of those applications, and people did some wonderful work doing that. Developers also even would just clip routines from it. They would clip certain, you know, UI gadgets or whatever to enhance their own applications. And it really, by providing that source code, made a developer much more effective and productive much more quickly.
Hmm. Now, you were able to take advantage of this because you were selling the hardware.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And, okay. Yeah. But
Donna, as you look at the way the market evolved over time, why do you think that, or how would you assess the quality of that ecosystem today that came up behind that open platform?
Well, I think that the Palm OS ecosystem continues to be very vibrant today, but there certainly are other handheld environments that have developer communities as well. I would say on a more general level, handheld development and seeing a handheld as a computer rather than a fixed function device has certainly become the norm. If you think about it, before the Palm Pilot, you had these little, organizers. Remember the electronic organizer business? That's gone. You don't get a fixed function electronic organizer today. You get a Palm Zire, a low-end Palm Pilot that has all the platform capabilities. So In a sense, the handheld environment has become a platform business entirely.
Mm-hmm. As you look at the development of where, the smartphone or the cell phone plus is going now, do you see a lot more closedness by the carriers in terms of what they're trying to do with those platforms, or do you see it going to a more open community and it's just, in its nascent stages?
Yes, I believe the latter. This will become an open business, very much along the lines of the computer business, but it's going to take a while. The carriers are from a different world, and the carriers are really not from a computing world and a platform world at all. What we're seeing in smartphones is a merging of communications and computing environments, and it's a colossal shift and a colossal change, and it's something that carriers don't have really any heritage in or any experience in. And furthermore, it's something that was detrimental to them in the past. They needed to control the network to deliver a good voice experience. Mm-hmm. You have to deliver 99.9 or whatever it is on the phone network. And you certainly can't have people having phones that crash, that have to be reset, that have bugs. And so it's a very scary world out there, the computing world. And let's face it, consumers have different standards for those worlds. We have unfortunately trained them in our industry, in the computing industry, to actually tolerate these problems, crashing computers and bugs and so on. Mm-hmm. And people haven't had to tolerate that in the phone world. And so now you see these worlds coming together and you see carriers taking a little bit of the view of, hey, these things have to work out of the box. Our customers are not going to be satisfied to be calling tech support, and the only way we can deliver that high-quality experience is in a very closed environment. And frankly, some of that's true, and our smartphones have much higher quality problems than the old handset business does in a good deal because of the openness and the complexity that openness delivers.
Mm-hmm. So how do you design it to be appropriately open yet still give make it robust enough? Because I remember the original Palm was, people loved it because it was fast and it was robust and even if it did crash, you could reset it in a few seconds.
Right. And I think a couple things have to happen. First of all, the products have to get better. They are clearly in an early stage still. The getting better is a complicated thing because there's obviously a big hardware element. There's device-side software. And then there's integration with the network, which is extremely complicated and, by the way, different from carrier to carrier. So no longer can you produce one standard off-the-shelf device like an early Palm Pilot that works everywhere. you have to create a version for Verizon, a version for Sprint, a version for Vodafone, and so on around the world. And that creates enormous complexity and enormous testing challenges. All that being said, the devices have to get better, the networks have to get better, and customers have to grow a little more tolerant of the understanding of the trade-off of robustness and complexity for a somewhat reduced quality of service. That's happening. That's the people who are buying smartphones today. Mm-hmm. You're not finding people down the sort of adopter curve buying smartphones today. It's a very, very teeny segment of an absolutely massive phone business. And that teeny segment are the early adopters who will tolerate a little more quality issue and who, by the way, give us fabulous feedback on how to make these things better as we get farther down the adoption curve in the future.
Do you think the whole voice over IP thing will be a critical way that the computing cluster and the computing kind of modularity comes into the phone business from the bottom up, if you will?
I certainly think voice over IP is going to play a role. There's just no doubt about it. How much of a role, though, is a little bit hard to tell at this stage. You can't cover the world with Wi-Fi today, mm-hmm. you know. In fact, we all know it's hard enough to cover the world with wide area networks. Mm-hmm. Probably the number one complaint people have is coverage out of, you know, the existing American carriers. Mm-hmm. They'll be a long way before they get coverage on Wi-Fi. So I think the key is could you evolve to a position where when you are in a Wi-Fi coverage, you can use voice over IP, and then when you roam to the wide area network, then you go onto the tariff network, and there certainly are a lot of people working on, there's a lot of challenges with that sort of problem today, but there certainly are people working on that. So I think eventually it will happen, but you got to realize that a lot of the time when you're on your cell phone, you're on the wide area network.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that some of the statistics I've been reading that's disturbing to me anyway is that we're 20th in the world in the United States in wireless broadband adoption, and we're in the teens in terms of wired broadband adoption. Do you see more interesting things happening outside the country or inside the country in terms of new applications and emerging behavior?
Well, look, we've been behind in cell phones, just starting with that, forgetting even the data side of the thing. Even on voice, we're mm-hmm. behind Europe and many other places in the world. So it's not surprising. We have some unique challenges in the U.S. I think there's two that we just have to keep in mind. One is our enormous geography. I mean, mm-hmm. this is a really big country, and it's very hard, and it's very expensive capital-wise to cover this country wirelessly. It's a lot of towers. Mm-hmm. So that is something that has been less of a problem in Europe, where you have sort of a smaller, more dense populated geography. The second issue we have in the U.S. that plagues us is that we have had multiple competing technologies. In other geographies, they settled early on a technology, in Europe on GSM, in mm-hmm. Korea, for example, on CDMA. Mm-hmm. Those places had a real advantage infrastructure-wise because they focused on a standard earlier that allowed them to focus their R&D efforts on that standard, but also made the first problem less bad. So, in other words, not only do we have a large physical geography to cover, we got to do it with three competing standards. So mm-hmm. that's even more expensive. Now, that's been consolidating, so we're getting down to two, but we were at five, I think. So we're getting down to CDMA and GSM and their next generations as being the two key standards. But that's taken us a long time, and I think that's harmed us in the U.S. I just see what it takes us as a cell phone manufacturer to do multiple devices for multiple standards. It's a mm-hmm. whole separate development. It's very costly. Mm-hmm. So if you had the advantage of a single standard earlier, you could progress faster. You know, what's happened in Korea with wideband CDMA has been spectacular. That's been a very early focus on a standard that's enabled them to progress very quickly there.
Mm-hmm. Going back to to the old days. Let's switch to hardware a bit. What was the Handspring experience with the plug-in modules, the Springboard?
Well, when we formed Handspring, we had just left Palm. We formed this new company, Handspring. We were going to do handheld computing again, and we wanted to differentiate from Palm our devices, obviously for marketing reasons. And the idea that we hit upon, or I should say Jeff Hawkins hit upon quite early, was the idea of hardware expandability. So we created this slot. We ended up naming it the Springboard slot and created a developer kit and a developer community to enable people to add value through hardware into the devices. That turned out to be relatively successful for us in differentiating the product. People did lots of terrific devices, from photo plug-in modules to barcode readers to insulin testers for diabetics and a wide range of very exciting applications. One of the main reasons, though, we did the Springboard product, which we didn't articulate at the time but was very much in our mind, was to understand communications. By the time we formed Handspring, we knew that the future of handheld computing would also be phones and the future of communications, and that these big colossal areas would come together. But we personally came from the computing industry and knew nothing about communications. So our idea was that this slot would enable us to learn about communications. I think our eighth employee was a very senior GSM engineer, Jerry Tu, who's still with Palm, as a matter of fact. So we were very early on looking at how we could use the Springboard slot for communications. And in the end, we gained enormous knowledge from that. We had devices shipping on the Springboard platform from reflex pagers to wireless phones to wide-area phones to Wi-Fi. Just about everything imaginable communications-wise did end up plugging into a visor, our handheld product. And we learned an awful lot from that, technically, things about, you know, RF and interference, business-wise, working with the carriers. It was really our university degree in communications was the Springboard slot.
Wow. And now, in the Trio, though, you went with the SD slot. Is that, you sort of gave up on the, well, was it proprietary, the Springboard, or?
Well, it depends on what you mean by proprietary. I always find people use these terms in different ways.
Did you encourage others?
It was an open platform. We owned it, but it was an open platform where developers could access the information to create, you know, the plug-in modules. But when we looked at Trio, we really wanted to use Springboard if we could, but we very quickly realized that to have a phone, form factor would be an enormous issue. And indeed, we had a phone module that plugged in the visor. It did not do well. It didn't do well for a few reasons. One was it wasn't a particularly good phone. That's a problem when you want a phone. But the other reason was that people hated it as form factor as a phone. They hated putting up this big, square, chunky thing to their head. They were used to a phone being smaller. So when we went to design the first Trio, which, if you recall, was larger than the current Trio and was in the flip form, we ended up deciding that we couldn't physically fit the Springboard slot much as we wanted to do that. We were obviously going to be integrating in all the communications functionality, but the I.O. just couldn't support a Springboard slot because it was just too big, bottom line.
So, but it turned out that having the open hardware edition really bought you something in the old days.
In the visor. Well, yeah, it bought us something. I'm not sure how much it bought our developer community. We never sold enough volume, and any one of those modules never sold enough to make it a great commercial experience for our developers. So in the end, in fairness to the developer community, I have to say it was a wonderful thing for us. It differentiated our products, and it gave us this education in communications. But it was, I would say, so-so results for the developer community, which I would not say is true on the Palm OS software side, bearing in mind, of course, that the cost of developing an add-on piece of software is substantially lower than the cost of developing a piece of hardware. Right. The developers on the visor side had real inventory that they had to contend with and real manufacturing, and it was a pretty big investment for those developers.
And Handspring was, you know, wasn't dominant in the market. It was large, but not that large.
Well, we were number two and number two pretty quickly, so we were 30% of the market. We rocketed to enormous volume. We were, at that point, the fastest-growing company in the history of American business, so it wasn't bad. But still, in order to have a platform that supports hardware development where you're investing in tooling and inventory, you need to have millions and millions of devices to sell that to because your attach rate's going to be relatively low. That's a big job.
So in today's world, you'd have to do it so it would work on, like, all cell phones. That would be a sufficient market.
In today's world, it'd be hard to justify a focused hardware add-on that's not through, say, a cable sort of connector for any given phone. I mean, unless that's a phone that's selling millions and millions of units. It's hard. It's a very expensive proposition. Well,
it would have to be a standard that every phone, I mean, every phone from every manufacturer type
right.
of thing.
But, you know, again, there's trade-offs. So you could somehow dictate a standard so phones were the same. You would reduce innovation enormously. And the reality is that the form factor of the form, the physical form factor, what it looks like, how it's rounded, how thick it is, in addition to the functionality, of course, but the form factor is one of the most critical things to people when they select a phone. So you can't force that for the developer community. It's a bad trade-off to make.
So you need something more like Bluetooth, but with the ability for anybody to innovate, so things just need to be near each other. That might do it.
Right, they need to be near each other, or you live with some cable connector jigs or things that let you plug in different connectors for different things. You could do a keyboard, for example, that had some sort of a removable connector, so you could put in different connectors, whatever. But you got to deal with the reality that physical form factor for phones has a wide, wide range, and I think will continue to for some time.
And there's the question of battery power for those things. Who provides the battery? Because that's always a question.
Right. Well, usually, you're going to have to bring additional power for anything that takes a lot of power because the phone uses a lot of power, and the battery life is another important factor for people.
I'm trying to figure out how to get John his fingerprint reader on his phone.
Right. Well, you could certainly imagine somebody doing a plug-in module through a serial port, but again, it's going to have to be sort of custom fit for a specific form factor because it's going to be hard to do something like that for every form factor.
Yeah, when you look at the diversity, it seems to be getting more diverse, whether you look at the Razer or the BlackBerry.
Right. But, I mean, right there, you've got, just in the smartphone space, you've got a pretty wide range. And even though they look somewhat similar, you can start seeing some themes emerge, physical keyboards and stick phones versus flip phones and so on. You see some themes. You know, themes don't help you if you got to create a tool and something's got to snap onto the back.
So software is more likely where you're going to see a lot of innovation, independent innovation.
I think so. You'll see some work on the hardware side, no doubt, and combinations. You know, Bluetooth is a great example of a hardware plus software combination that is device independent, which is terrific. So you'll see more things like that.
Mm-hmm. What's your sense of what the thing you carry in your pocket is going to evolve to over the next, well, pick your time period. Is the right time period for a lot of innovation the next 2 years, or is it going to take five, or what do you think?
Well, sure, I think things are going to continue to innovate. We're really in the very beginning of this space. It's very exciting. You know, if you look back historically, when we made the first pilot and we went around looking for a display for it, for example, we had a real tough time finding a vendor to supply us with any display. People were trying to get to big color notebook displays. That's where the money was, and we were going around looking for a small monochrome display, and nobody wanted to sell it to us. It took us finding the paging guys who looked at this as a big display relative to their paging displays to get excited about it and sell us a display. You know, even being willing to tool for and sell a display, it was an argument. Now, today, you look at how much opportunity there is on the display side, which is the single largest cost for the device, and there's been just enormous choice that's evolved over the years, some spectacular color displays and interesting things happening on the research side. So the volumes in the business, and the more it becomes the cell phone business, the more we'll see innovations on the component side that let us integrate into better and better devices. And then you're seeing tremendous innovations on the network side. All the carriers are beginning to understand data. They are investing in these high-speed networks. But this stuff we're moving to next generation is just phenomenal in terms of what we're going to be able to do with it, just faster and faster broadband speeds into these devices. So that network advantage is going to make a whole realm of opportunity on the content and application side become available. Now you're looking at more audio and more video and all collaborative applications and all sorts of things you can imagine on top of it. So it's really becoming very much computing and is very exciting.
Is there an application area that you think is going to be interesting over the next little bit?
Oh, I think, as always, the developer community will show such a range of applications that there's nothing that won't be tried. You know, I mean, I don't focus on any one particular area. Probably, to me, one of the most exciting things about the application area is the opportunity for third world, if you will, applications and taking computing to a whole new community. If you look at computers going into the lesser developed world the way they are today and getting internet access for people, it just wasn't going to happen. You're not going to have these expensive PCs that need to plug in a power supply that have a, you know, IT person for every 10 PCs. It's just too expensive. Whereas if you look at the phone as a computer, the smartphone is expensive for a phone today, but it's pretty cheap for a computer. And you have these ubiquitous wide area networks. As they get faster and faster, the idea that this will be internet access and computing to a whole range of our world that has not been able to connect to the network for financial reasons, to me, is one of the most exciting, compelling things that's going to happen here.
Mm-hmm. We have to leave open the long tail applications. I mean, it sounds.
Yes,
like,
of course.
I mean, well, no. Well, you really believe in that, and the question is, do the carriers believe in that? As this, you talk about this learning about other fields. Are the carriers learning about that? That the applications are going to come from others, and you know, if they act as arbiters of it, it's going to be a problem.
I think what you see in the carriers today is a wide range. You have certain carriers who are much more aggressive on this issue, and you have other carriers who are less so. And this, in a sense, is going to end up being a differentiator for the carriers. Those who embrace it and get on board are going to have, in my view, a more robust strategy in this part of the space. But they're also going to deal with this trade-off that I talked about earlier of complexity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, are they going to be able to have people who man the phones who you can call to say, my phone is not syncing with my Windows XP running over, you know, this sort of protocol with my firewall and my blah, 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 blah. You get into these sort of complex technical issues when you're interacting with the world that they have to be prepared to step up to supporting, which is not their history.
So they're making
that trade-off.
I just flashed to a nightmare. I just had a nightmare experience with a what will be unnamed carrier connecting up a phone, just getting the phone to turn on and change the ESN to the new ESN and the phone I had in my hand, and the idea of them doing troubleshooting on combination of Windows, Bluetooth, and the onboard operating system.
It's just very hard. You know, just to cut the carriers a little bit of a break, you know, they're in a very tough business. It's just cutthroat competitive. They have, you know, enormous challenges in just keeping up, and they got this thing coming at them, computing, that is hard. It is very hard. Think about their sales process, their enterprise sales force. You know what the enterprise sales force at a major carrier used to be? It's somebody who sits in the company cafeteria and signs up people for plans. It's not somebody who calls on the CIO of an IT department that's trying to put in a complex integrated solution. So the carriers are having to make a decision of where do I stand? If I'm going to be a player in this, I got to invest in a true enterprise sales force. I got to invest in enormous tech support. I've got to invest across the board when I'm investing in all these other things. And it's a pretty big strategic hurdle to cross. So now, Some of them are doing it better than others, and I believe they will all do it at some point or another. They will have to do it. But, by the way, we on the device side, we have to make these things less complex. We have to build our solutions such that they work together. You're seeing these things happening, but it is definitely hard. You know, it takes a lot of hard work.
Are there ways of sharing? I mean, in a lot of the computing world, we've learned to go with standards. We all do it the same way, even, you know, not doing vertically integrated the same way, but each taking our own piece and sharing common stuff. Is there a part of the cell phone world that could happen that it hasn't yet?
Well, certainly some of that happens at the standards level. You have GSM, you have GSM. They have been working on the data standards, and they've made a lot of progress on data standards, but there's still a ways to go on that. I think one of the hardest parts of the standard part is the application side. If you look at photos, for example, all these phones have photos, but each carrier has somewhat their own photo sharing software and system and process, and
yeah.
We can shield people a little bit from that on the device side. We make it try to look the same, but the back end is being run by the carrier, so that's one of the things that has to change from carrier to carrier when you do these devices is hooking into their back end photo application.
But that's part of their vertical thinking as opposed to horizontal thinking, where you know they all use one type of standard and don't try to do it all themselves.
Well, but, I mean, again, I'll take their view a little bit, that this is a part of what they're trying to do to build a differentiated product, because they look at their situation and say, gee, if we have all the value on the handset side and on the application side and we're a dumb pipe, we're into this low gross margin cutthroat business because we don't have differentiation and value added. So they're all looking to figure out how can they add value. How are they going to differentiate against their competitor set? And some of that is evolving with these experiments over time of which piece of the application they have. Now, we've had handset guys say to us, carriers say to us, we've gone with our devices and said, okay, you know, here's what we're going to do on photos. And they say, no, you have to make the client-side photo app look identical to all of our other clients because we want to control the app to the handset level, and for our customers, it needs to look the same. And we say, you know, that's crazy because we all have a different UI. We have a five-way on the Trio. This other guy over here doesn't have a five-way. We have to five-way enable our app. It's going to look different with the handset being different. So this has been a little bit of an education process with them to say, no, we can't produce a bad product in order for you to have a consistent application across your handsets. That would be the wrong choice.
So there's this whole education thing again. You went through it when you had to learn about wireless and hardware and stuff like that, you know, the connected stuff, this whole, you know, being an RF, et cetera. What can the carriers, what should be a good learning experience? If we were going to put up a carrier university, what do they need to learn to understand this stuff?
Well, I think they're learning it as they go, and I think practically speaking, that's probably the way it's going to happen, just as we learned telecom as we went through, you know, products like the Visor phone, which were not particularly successful. And I think that if you don't learn it by doing it, you never believe it. So these guys have to do tech support for these devices for a while and see what their tech support numbers and their systems are in order to be able to understand what it means to provide support. They have to do some enterprise sales to understand what it means to support an enterprise in this environment. And, by the way, they are leaning on us very heavily because they keep saying to us, you guys have to understand what quality means in our environment. You know, you have to make this stuff work better. And they're right. So it's a sharing of experience here to help advance this stuff beyond the early adopter community.
So is this understanding all sides the biggest, you know, what's the biggest challenge to getting a truly open cell phone that's as open as the PC was when Intuit did Quicken and or the Sound Blaster card came out?
Well, I think we're there in terms of openness. The Trio is a very open platform. Anybody can develop an app on it who wants to. Anybody can plug into the serial port. If they want to bother tooling up for something, we'll give them the information.
Can I take over the cell phone call?
can you take over the cell phone call? You know, I'm not sure how far you can go on that. There are restrictions that the networks have of how far you can go into the communications protocols and the communications stack, with them having, you know, rightfully so, issues of needing to protect the network and make sure that network access is not, you know, hijacked. You know, we're going to have a terrible security problem with these devices as well that everybody is worried about and looking at and understanding viruses and rogue things going on with an always-on device.
That's what they,
so, you know, when we were only sometimes on, it was a whole different situation. Now we're always on. So, you know, you gotta make sure that you're cutting them a little slack on that side. That being said, certainly you want to get to the data of the call. How long was the call? Where'd the call go to? There's all sorts of interesting applications you can put on top of it for time tracking, for example. And we struggled initially with the carriers on applications like that until they finally let us get access to that data about the data of the call so that you can feed that into a, another application layer that's quite interesting. So I think we're pretty far along the way of openness. Where we are, however, is a very small penetration into the cell phone community. I mean, smartphones are selling a couple million units a year, and cell phones are selling 400 million units a year. So what we have is essentially a very open, extremely small part of the business. So what we really need to do to make it a bigger piece of the business so that this openness can be really appreciated and explored and commercialized and make a viable commercial opportunity is a lot bigger market, and that's going to take lower-cost phones, higher-quality phones, easier and easier to use and deploy, and those things, I think, are a matter of time at this point. They will happen.
Well, it also might be a particular set of long-tail applications, some of which become short-tail. I'm thinking of connection. I'd like my app to have access to the earphone and the microphone during the call. Maybe it should be doing, a voice recognition during the call or something, or bridging together a voice over IP and a cell phone call at the same time. There's so many things. Whereas you say you have to want to do that to build the interfaces such that you break things, make them safe. This happened to the phone system when after the Carter phone decision, and then when MCI, you know, and others pushed so that you could put your own phone on the phone network. They were saying then that the phone network was going to die because I'd connect my own equipment.
Right.
Of course,
right.
It turned out they figured out that wasn't the case with a little bit of work.
Yes. No, and that's clearly what's going to happen here. And as I say, I think they get closer and closer to it. I'm not as familiar technically with where that line is drawn today, so I can't really comment on it. But I do believe that you will get more and more access over time as we get smarter about developing the devices and the carriers get smarter about the evolution of the network.
Yeah. And then it sounds like the number of minutes, we're going to be laughing that we used to talk about minutes as opposed to 24/7 connectivity. You know?
Yes, sure, absolutely. Well, you know, you get broadband in these phones, and it really changes the whole environment. There's no doubt that, and there's going to be a lot of learning. Now, people are experimenting with that, with UMTS in Europe and with advanced CDMA in Korea and so on. So people are beginning to see what some of those applications are and getting some of that experience, but we're still working on those things here.
Well, anything else you guys want to cover? We've been going a long time.
I just want to say it's such a treat to talk to you, Don, because you've been, your whole career has been about doing fascinating things at the edge and really making a difference in what we have in our hand.
Well, I see the theme in my career very clearly as having been about personal computing. You know, when I first met Dan and Bob Frankston, and they presented at Harvard Business School, I think that was 1981, Dan?
Probably.
Showed VisiCalc on an Apple II. It was the one with the little Sanyo monitor and the disk drives and 40K, or 40-column display, uppercase only, 16K,
oh, yeah.
I think. And I saw VisiCalc running, and it changed my life. I just said, you know, boy, these computers are going to be on everybody's desk. This is incredible. And I have really spent the next, 24 years working on exactly that, the notion of computing getting more and more accessible, broader and broader applications, more and more compelling, smaller, cheaper, all those things easier to use, has been the continuation of my career, first at Apple and at Claris, Apple software subsidiary, then at Palm and Handspring, and really continually taking personal computing to the next level. And in some sense, it's interesting because our new work at Numenta, the new company working on artificial intelligence and neuroscience, is a different kind of continuation of that, which is saying, okay, the next generation of computing we really think is going to be about intelligent computing. So the picture for me has always been about what is the next generation of computing, and to be a part of that has been a tremendous honor for me in my career. So it's just been a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Well, thanks very much, Donna, for joining John and me today. And to have somebody who you may have wanted to put a computer on every desk, but you ended up putting one in every pocket, you know, one of the few handful in that who can, you know, will be the name. That's just incredible. Well, this has been another in the Diamond Cluster Wavelengths podcast series covering the open cell phone. For more information about this series of podcasts, go to podcast.diamondcluster.com.